Okay, let's do it.
Welcome to the monthly podcast. This is Referee's World.
Hello again and welcome to Referee's World. My name is Darren Cullum. I'm a level 5 referee with Somerset FA and this is my mentor and PGM Earl assessor, Richard Mellon.
Yeah, hi Darren.
We can't be in the same studio tonight, so we're doing this via the technologies and wonders of Skype. I'm missing you, mate.
Yeah, I'm missing you too.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Like a hole in the head. Right, okay, coming up on the show then, we've got a few plum appointments. It was the FA Cup first round recently, and this includes a referee who's here in the UK on an exchange programme, Rich. That's quite an interesting one.
Yeah, this is first time ever, I think. I'm pretty certain in saying that. Let me just explain a little bit more about the background. There's been a Japanese exchange, and colleague from Japan, referees in the J-League. He is a professional referee, refereed in the first round of the FA Cup. And this is like an exchange, as I said, that where two of our lads, Anthony Taylor and Lee Probert, went across to Japan in July for 3 weeks and refereed in their league. And it's really encouraging to know that we can do this. And referees, it's not, you know, it isn't alien in other countries. It's a different culture, of course. But refereeing is an international language. The FA Cup, for some referees, half a dozen, I think I've got it right, whereby level 2 referees have been given FA Cup first round appointments, which is very, very unusual because they're normally given to Football League referees. And these level 2 referees are National List assistant referees and in their own right, level 2 referees.
Now, why do you think the FA have made a change?
I think, you know, if you look at the appointments, some of the appointments are not involving Football League clubs. And, you know, that's part of the background to it. You know, these are clubs that are normally refereed by these guys. And even in some cases, I think the club may be from lower down in the pyramid. So, you know, good luck to them. I hope the ball runs nicely for all of them. And fingers crossed there is no incidents.
I think as well what it's doing is bringing the new boys through, isn't it? Because they're going to have to gain experience somewhere. So why not give them experience on a cup game?
Yeah, tomorrow's referees. This is what this is about. We know who's today's referees are, but who's going to be tomorrow's referees? And tomorrow's referees are listening to this podcast.
This is Referee's World.
Also to come on this episode, we'll discuss pundits and players who are trying to change the rules, the wearing of spectacles, Kalina rejecting goal line technology, and refereeing in 10-minute slots. Okay, let's go back to these plum appointments. Now, obviously, by the time you listen to this, the games would have been done. However, we would just like to mention a couple of the guys that were involved, Rich.
Yeah, a couple of the lads that are involved as level 2 referees. Give a plug to John Hopkins, refereed Cambridge United versus Wrexham. Tim Robinson, refereed Redbridge FC versus Oxford City. Andy Davis, refereed Bristol Rovers versus Corby. Now, for level 2 referees, that's a real good challenge. Another one is Chelmsford City versus AFC Telford, Declan Ford. Sutton United versus Kettering Town, Mick Ball. Good luck, Mick. I know you listen. Kev Johnson. I know Kev Johnson listens. He's doing AFC Totten versus Bradford Park Avenue. And if you remember, I did mention that we had an exchange referee involved in the FA Cup first round, Thomas Masaki. I hope I've got that correct. But Thomas is on the referee exchange. He's a Japanese referee, referees in the J-League in Japan, and he's over here on the exchange.
Is the J-League like the equivalent to the Premier League?
Yes, it is. It's well supported. It's furiously well supported, probably not of the same high level as the Premier League, but it looks as though it could slot somewhere into the Football League.
This is Referee's World.
OK, let's discuss striking referees, but this time at not such a high level. This is Sunday League referees in Oldham, which all sounds a bit random, really. Tell us the story, Rich.
Well, this has come about through press announcements, obviously, and it's been pushed around by the Manchester Evening News. Now, it just says Oldham Sunday League referees go on strike. And reading the press, and I hope if any of our colleagues in the Oldham Sunday League referees list are listening, perhaps you get in touch and give us the full story, but I'm only using what I can read in the paper. And basically, the Sunday League banned players beginning of the season who were considered to be nuisance threatening, intimidating type players. And, you know, they have got a history of dismissals and that type of thing. So the referees were happy to hear that news at the beginning of the season. And then all of a sudden, the Sunday League appear to have reversed their decision and have given the last chance to these guys who are a little bit fuggish, we'll say, because that's the word that's being used in the press. And the referees have said, hey, we're not happy about that. These guys are intimidating, they're threatening, they're abusive. And basically, the Oldham Sunday League referees have gone on strike. I mean, my personal view, as a referee, I wouldn't refuse to referee entirely. I would go and referee elsewhere, or I'd referee teams where these guys are not involved, if that were the case. So I look at it, and reading what the press release says, they've actually gone on strike and refused to referee in that Sunday league. Well, I consider that is penalising the good guys, which is, I think is a little bit unfair. If you don't want to referee certain teams, and there are certain teams everywhere in the country that people sort of dread refereeing, some of us even like refereeing that type of team because that's the big challenge.
I was going to say, that's one of the big challenges you face as a referee, because if you're going to turn up every week at a game which is neither here nor there, or the players were not bothered, then personally, you wouldn't get much from it. I don't think so. Anyway, I know I wouldn't.
I mean, I won't name teams in our particular area where I've refereed, but there is a well-known team, or two, in fact, whereby, they've got notorious pit players playing who, out on the streets, you wouldn't like to meet in a dark alley. They are intimidating. They do have a very strong opinion, and they are intimidating. And, me being 5'6" and 11.5 stone when I was at my fighting weight, you know, I accepted that challenge and I enjoyed that. Perhaps, you know, theoretically, I was having a fight with them at the time, but it never got to fisticuffs in the true sense. Of course, one or two had to take the walk, and so they did. But there was no comeback from that. There was another team that I remember refereeing, and there was a dismissal in the game for a headbutt by a player, and you know he had no comeback about what he did and what I did. He was dismissed for the headbutt on an opponent. He didn't appeal. The club were called in to a disciplinary because the assistant referee, or the club assistant referee, came up to me at halftime and said, "You're all right, ref?" I said, "Yeah, I don't think we're going to finish this game." And when I said that comment, I meant we wouldn't have enough players. But he went and told his team, the referee feels threatened. So that all sorts of things can come from these things. And so maybe, you know, things could be misunderstood. And if our colleagues in the Oldham Sunday League are listening, or anybody connected with that, perhaps they get in contact and straighten up the real story and not let the press, you know, sensationalise it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can contact us through the website, which is refereesworld.co.uk. I can think of an incident where I had a game where quite a few of the players were threatening, so much so I went back to the changing rooms, grabbed my bag, and one of the referees that was in the room next to me, I said to him, "Mate, can you give me a lift to my car? I didn't have a shower or anything, and it was a really wet, windy day, and I was caked in mud, but I did feel really threatened that day." So he dropped me off where my car was parked, which was down the other end of the playing field. But I think that's probably the only time I remember. And I don't actually remember having one of those games where I felt I didn't give the right decisions. They were just not agreeing to the decisions that I gave.
Yeah, it is very difficult, and I do sympathise and empathise with my colleagues. But at the end of the day, we sign up. Basically, we go for a contract. We will be unbiased. We will uphold the laws. And I just say, come on, let's get on and do it, lads.
OK, let's move on then. It's the Referees World podcast with Darren Cullum and Richard Mellin. What's this about pundits and players trying to change the rules, Rich?
Yeah, this is a little bit of a beef that I've got at the moment involving pundits on TV. And I'll go back to the incident involving New Zealand versus Wales in the World Cup semi-final. The player for Wales who sort of...
Sam Warburton.
Yeah, I was going to say Warburton, but I wasn't sure. He basically spear-tackled the guy. Now, I mean, I don't know enough about rugby refereeing to say that he was right or he's wrong, but when you look at it, it's hugely dangerous, and it was done without due care in the tackle. Tackle is in football, tackle is in rugby. So, you know, what's wrong and what's right? What's acceptable, what's not acceptable? I just say that tackle looked very, very dangerous.
Well, that tackle, that actual tackle, style of tackle in rugby is an illegal move, whether it was a soft tackle or a hard tackle. The way he did it, it was an illegal move. And look, you can get all roped and tied up in the passion of all this, can't you? But it was an illegal move. The players admitted it was an illegal move, and the referee did what he had to do.
Yeah, that's what it appeared to be, and that's what we do as referees. Now, I just want to go a little bit further with this conversation, because at half time on that match, the pundits were sat there saying the referee was totally wrong, and through their own insistence, they were saying that he should have considered the occasion. Now, first round of the cup, first league match of the season, cup final, last league match of the season, it should not matter. The rules are still the same in any competition. The rules are made in any competition to protect the players. And that's what referees are there to do, protect the players. Now, like I say, at halftime in that rugby league, in that rugby union semi-final, the pundits were giving the referee a real hard time. Now, whatever happened to this gentlemanly thing about rugby? It's all of a sudden changing, and people are getting behind the mic, getting a little bit carried away. And if they're looking at football and always saying, well, football's always got it wrong, I don't agree, because at the end of the day, let's go to the football side of it now. Almost the same weekend, maybe just after, the Liverpool-Everton dismissal for the, is it the Jack Rodwell
Jack
challenge?
Jack Rodwell, yeah.
Yeah, for the challenge on the Liverpool player. Now, from where Martin Atkinson was, he saw a straight leg challenge. Straight leg challenge is not acceptable. In Martin's opinion, straight leg challenge, and it's a red card offence.
Yeah.
So Martin took the appropriate action. Now, if Martin's problem was highlighted on the day in refereeing terms, I hope everybody listening understands when you can be too close and you don't get the full angle of what's going on. So I think that's where it was as regards a slight issue for Martin, but Martin made an honest decision.
Do you think that the FA undermined him by reducing the red card?
No, they would have consulted Martin and asked him to review his decision. Now, when you look at a DVD, and we can all do that because it's done on Match of the Day Saturday nights, you can make a slightly different decision or you can make the same decision. And on this occasion, Martin would have looked at the DVD and, you know, he would have put it in somewhere in his report and said, yeah, I can understand why people say it's not a red card offence, but from where I was on the occasion, it was. And my decision will be final on the day, but the authorities have the, you know, the position, the discretion to overturn the decision if they think it was incorrect. And with Martin's agreement, I think that's how they got to their decision. So all I want to say is on these pundits, let's go to another game involving Chelsea and QPR. Didier Drogba, definitely sent off for a two-footed challenge, uncontrolled, not controlled of his legs, et cetera, and made a two-footed challenge. That's a straightforward red card. Agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Right. The other issue involving in that game, and this is on the technical side of the law, involved Bosuinga, the Chelsea fullback, who I think fouled Wright Phillips, if I'm correct in saying picking on the two players. I know the Chelsea player was Bosuinga. If the player's going through on goal, and it makes no difference if the challenge is careless, reckless, or with excessive force, but if he's going to deny an obvious goal-scoring opportunity by making a foul for which he's going to be penalised, the letter of the law will be applied because he's denied an obvious goal-scoring opportunity. And if he's going to give a foul, he's going to decide dog-so. And dog-so it was.
Yeah.
So on the technical side of it, although it wasn't, we'll say, aggressive, but it was careless nonetheless because it was given as a foul and Bosuinga was given the suspension appropriate. So, you know, people sit in the studios behind the microphones, making their judgments, making a life out of what they talk about, berating referees. And which leads us on to another thing, which I don't think we should talk about on this occasion, Darren. But should referees come out after a game, stand in front of the mic and explain their decisions?
I don't think they should. I think what would be a good idea is if, I know that Dermot Gallagher does this occasionally for Sky TV, doesn't he? If they had an ex-professional that has been there and done it, okay, at the highest level, that can perhaps sit with the pundits and explain why a certain decision has been made.
That's true. And they're educated by what they hear and see on TV.
Exactly.
The only thing I'd like to say about Dermot's contribution through Sky, I think it's a really, really good idea. but it doesn't get that much interest from football people. I mean, Dermot will go on there and explain situations, and he explains it really, really well. And being an ex-pro referee, and he's been at top-level competitions, he explains it. Is that really what Sky want, or do they want pundits in there giving a little bit of, sensationalism, saying he should have been sent off, et cetera, et cetera? Because the other thing I was going to say was, you remember a couple of seasons ago, just after Paul Durkin retired from the Premier League referees list, he went on Match of the Day too. And I think he was on a couple of episodes. But at the end of the day, when you've got a referee sat there who's been in the heat explaining the referee's decisions, it doesn't cause any major interest. The only people that are interested in listening to that is us, the referees. And so 28,000 referees in the country isn't a big enough audience for Sky, is it?
And it's all about the money, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I want Sky to keep feeding their money in. I want the TV and the media people keep feeding their money in. So it keeps helping football progress.
And I'm sure it won't be the last time that we discuss this.
No, certainly not.
OK, this is something that we have talked about in the past, the wearing of spectacles. Now, recently we've talked about the wearing of hearing aids for players and for referees as well. But the wearing of spectacles is, as you were saying earlier on, Rich, is actually probably more important because there's a lot more people, well, not more important, but there's a lot more people that are likely to wear spectacles on the field of play.
Yeah, I actually remember a colleague of mine here in Bridgewater where we... locally, Ken Turner used to wear glasses as he was refereeing. And if I used, he wore the Ronnie Barker type glasses, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Open all hours.
Yeah, brilliant.
But yeah, Ken wore those when he was refereeing, and that was when I was still playing. So, you know, it's nothing new, to be perfectly honest. But wearing of glasses, I mean, yeah, there are safety issues for referees to consider. And I just say to my colleagues, please, referees, make sure that you're satisfied that if a player is wearing glasses, they are not dangerous to the opponent or especially to himself. You know, glasses do need to be safe. And I'm just going to use a reference that I've got here and reading from it. So apologise. In view of the new technology that has made sports spectacles much safer, both for the wearer and for other players, referees should allow tolerance when authorising their use, particularly for younger players. Now, this refers to players under the age of 11. So, you know, there are certain issues here which we need to consider. And they give an idea of what sports spectacles should be made of and how they should be worn. This is being looked at by, you know, professional opticians. And so that's where the sort of... what can I say, the guidance comes from.
The only problem is, though, Rich, is the cost, because they're not cheap.
Oh, no, we know they're not, Darren. And you and I have actually spoken to a player that you refereed.
Yeah.
You know, he came on, you did the inspection, but you did the inspection before the game. You know, that's how it should be done. But it says here, can players wear spectacles or goggles when playing football? Flying footballs and close physical contact make football a moderate risk sport for eye injuries. Spectacles or goggles may provide protection from injury and can also be worn with those who need to wear prescription lenses. So, polycarbonate lenses. This is the most important property of all the protective spectacles or goggles. So, good polycarbonate is virtually unbreakable and will sustain the impact of a ball or a finger. And, you know, I've seen them. They are good, but they are expensive, as you highlight. And I think there's somewhere around about the last estimate or the comment they've given to me. I think they're about 140 quid. Mm. Is that fairly accurate?
Yeah, between 100 and 150 pounds.
Yeah. And then a sports band, which is what someone's mentioned here, an elasticated band and not a temple across the pieces should secure the frame. So a sports band around that type of thing would help. Players must have something that will be secured tight to the head so that the spectacles or goggles won't fall off. A frame with temples will not hold tight enough, and a jab from a finger could lift the frame off or potentially damage the eye. So, you know, it is a very, very awkward situation. Mm. And when you get down to young players, 11-year-old lads, and I've been there myself, and anybody listening to this, when you make an inspection of players' equipment, if there's an 11-year-old wearing glasses and you ask him to take them off and he says, I need to play with them, my mum and dad say I can play with them, you then need to go and speak to somebody, an adult, who's actually organising the team and, you know, the manager, the secretary, and confirm that all this is, you know, is it has been approved and agreed. Because, you know, I don't want to stop anybody playing football. You know, especially an 11-year-old, 12-year-old lad or girl that want to play. But at the end of the day, I also have a responsibility to make sure that they remain safe on the field of play. And if they need to wear spectacles, then I need to highlight the, you know, the consequences if there's an accident. And that would be my concern. You know, you've only got one pair of eyes and, you know, you don't want to get a damage to them through sort of neglect as a referee, or the player has a problem through neglect of the referee's responsibilities. So very awkward situation. Please, referees, check. And, you know, make sure if you're refereeing youngsters that you get the agreement and the understanding of the people that are running the team.
If in doubt, bail out, i.e. if you're really not sure, then stand your ground and say, sorry, but you're not coming on the field to play with those glasses. It's hard. I know it's difficult. I've done this a couple of times myself. For doing so, I ran the risk at the time of getting quite a lot of abuse from the team. But, you know, I stood my ground with it, and I just felt it was right. It was the first time ever happened for me. And I just thought, okay, no, I'm not going to take the chance, because if anything goes wrong here. And it was a game between two teams that have history as well. So it was always going to be quite choppy, which adds to the danger element.
Yeah. And if anybody asks you, what's your problem, referee? You're just staying on the side of safety.
Where the problem lies as well is because there are other referees that perhaps let things go. So the response you'll get is, oh, the referee last week let us do it, or the referee the week before last let us do it, blah, blah, blah. So then you're sort of falling into a line of inconsistency.
Yeah, the thing that, you know, I use the word carefully here, but the thing that scares me a little bit is this society in which we live in, whereby anybody seems willing to sue somebody for neglect. And a referee is open to that if it's proven guilty. You know, we do have a responsibility, and the laws of the game are written with safety in mind. Mm-hmm. So that's why I just ask my colleagues to consider that on every time they make a decision involving this type of thing.
This is Referees World.
Okay, something previously discussed, goal line technology, which, let's be honest about it, comes round every so often, doesn't it? Now then, Rich was telling us in the last episode that we could expect goal line technology in the Premiership by March, April of next year. Since we had that discussion, Pierluigi Collina has piped up with his thoughts on goal line technology, and quite surprisingly, he's gone and rejected it.
Yeah, I can't say he's rejected it, because it's not his decision, Dara. But, you know, having had this discussion, and we will have the discussion again, I made the quote that it could be trialled in April next year, but it doesn't look as though it's going to happen, because I've read an article recently where a quote has been made by Pierluigi Collina that he doesn't think goal line technology is necessary, because they're using six match officials with match officials based behind each goal line. So that's why he doesn't think goal line technology is necessary.
I wonder whether or not, had the game not become so commercialised and there's so much money, that they'd be going down the line of discussions of goal line technology, and it would just stick to the classical game like it was in the 70s, raw and, you know, a good game of football with a lot of good atmosphere and a lot of passion.
Yeah, I was a player in the 70s and the 80s. Come on, don't go on about this stuff in the 70s as raw. You make it sound like, you know, we were bloodthirsty. Anyhow.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
I was only trying to dramatise it, like we were saying earlier on. Us people in the media, we do all that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Remember, you're a referee on this occasion. Let's just think about it, because at the end of the day, the professional game, and let's start with FIFA and UEFA, they will go down the lines of, I think, how they have already approached it. And it appears that if Pierluigi Collina is already saying that we don't need goal line technology because we have six match officials with an additional one behind each goal line, then goal line technology is not going to happen. That's my view at the moment, because let's consider the cost. Now, I'm a Surrey boy by birth. My team is Aldershot Town. Now, professional club that they are, they cannot afford goal line technology. So who's going to pay for it? Arguably, people will say there's enough money floating around in the game at the moment that everybody should, you know, the authority should pay for it. Now, the FA or the PGMO, the FA Premier League, who's going to pay for it? How much is it going to cost? And I think it's going to cost a staggering amount of money. And clubs won't want to pay for it themselves. Some clubs, you could arguably say, can afford it themselves, but the remainder will be reluctant to fork out money that, you know, to buy it. And so consequently, go back, if six men per match, or six persons per match, should I say, sorry, ladies, if six persons per match are going to be appointed, then there's going to be a shuffle along all the levels, because six match officials on the Premier League means extra bodies needed, six match officials on the Football League, if it's going to happen there, so more bodies needed. And so you can see the shuffle all the way along the ladder beginning to happen. And so I say to guys now, those that, if you're listening to this, if you're level seven or level six, looking to make progress, let's get on your bike, let's get on with this, because if this six persons per game does happen, I don't think it's very far away. So let's get educated, let's get up there, and let's have a bit of it.
Okay, then, before we read some of your emails, let's talk about refereeing in 10-minute slots. Rich, it's all about breaking down the game, because of certain times in the game, people remember things more so than other times. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a fair way of looking at it. If you've given a penalty in the last 10 minutes or not given a penalty in the last 10 minutes, disallowed a goal, given a goal, you know, a key moment in the game in the last 10 minutes, people will remember the last 10 minutes. So take this package in one go here. Let's break the game down into 10-minute slots. Where are the most important slots in the game, Darren?
First 10 minutes, last 10, 15 minutes, I would suggest, and then 10 minutes either side of the interval.
Yeah, fair play. Good recognition. Why do you say first 10 minutes, first 10, 15 minutes?
Well, because the first 10, 15 minutes, for me personally, that's when you set the pace of the game. You know, it gives the players chance for them to look at you as the referee and decide in their own mind whether this referee is going to let the play carry on, whether he's going to, or she is going to blow the whistle every time there's a challenge. So, in the first 10 minutes, they'll be sussing you out as much as you're sussing them out.
Of course. So what we're actually talking about here is tolerance, isn't it?
Yeah.
What will you accept as a referee, and what won't you accept as a referee? If you allow too much to go in the first 10, 15 minutes, the players are working you out. And it's well known, players will try to work you out. They'll try and work out the opposition, and they'll see what they can get away with. So I think you and I have talked before, Dar, about not putting your early control at risk by allowing too much advantage or missing half fouls, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. You know, if he mistimed a challenge, although he didn't make contact, if he'd made contact, you'd think, oh, you know. And so consequently, it's still within your game plan to blow up and give a free kick. It will allow players to see what you will accept and what you won't accept. So that first 10, 15 minutes is crucial. Start bossing throw-ins in the first 10, 15 minutes, in the first few minutes, actually. You know, if there's a throw-in, just set your tolerance level and don't allow players to nick 3 or 4 yards on the first throw-in after 2 minutes. Start putting them in the right place from the start, and players will start working with you much earlier than you expect, and you don't have to pull the game back. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think you'll also gain a level of respect from them as well.
Of course. You're looking to manage players, and players will respect management so long as it's fair, firm, and consistent. You know, so like I say, don't allow players to pinch yards early in the game. Otherwise, it grows and grows and grows. And then all of a sudden, you know, you start penalising players in the last 15 minutes for pinching yards, but you haven't done it for the previous 75. Then go on to either side of halftime, Dan. What are you thinking?
Well, I mean, if you're there's all obviously when you're approaching half time, there's a psychological advantage, isn't there? Particularly if you score 5-10 minutes before you go into the break, and it can change. Well, it can change an awful lot, because obviously that then changes the way in which the players come out for the second half of the game, which probably means you're going to have to probably be a bit more alert than you were in the first 10 minutes of the game starting.
Equally, yeah, definitely, because you know, having conceded a goal just before half time, there's. People might say, "Well, that's only applicable at the professional game." No, it's copycat stuff down here at grassroots as well. You know, conceding a goal just before half time, everybody goes in buoyant. They're all, you know, they're all up for it. And then all of a sudden, after a half time team talk, the opposition who went 1-0 down just before half time come out of the traps really quick for the first 5-10 minutes of the second half. So you know, game on. So you know, don't relax, referee. Keep your guard up. And keep at it all the time. Important chunks of the game, do have a key impact at times. What are you thinking about as the last 10, 15, Darren?
Well, the last 10, 15 minutes, obviously, particularly in a cup game, it can certainly get a bit sort of fractious at times, particularly if you've got a team that's sort of 1-0 down and it's two teams of a level pegging in the league, perhaps they're going to want to have a go at the team that's ahead of them, aren't they? So, and they know the clock's on them, so they feel pressured.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what I want to say to my colleagues listening is that last 10, 15 minute period is as crucial as any. I appreciate that, and that's, I don't want to undervalue any part of the game. But this last 10, 15 minutes, I would say to you, game's tight. Don't risk your control and start playing too much advantage. Stop playing almost for every foul. And you're really killing the game to some extent. I know people will say that, but retain your control. Retain your players' respect if you've achieved that. So don't put your control at risk.
Equally, you're protecting the players, because if challenges are starting to get a little more fractious towards the end of the game, there is more likelihood that a player could get injured.
Absolutely right. The other thing I want to say to you is it probably is a little bit difficult for our colleagues that have just started off on the refereeing ladder in terms of stamina and trying to get a pace within the game. But work much harder in those last 10, 15 minutes, trying to identify getting closer to play, on top of play, and stopping players through your presence and deter any silliness that comes, and be very, very close to any potential confrontation. Don't stand back and wait for it to happen. See if you can stop it from happening. And I don't mean by pulling players apart, because I don't agree with that particular style of refereeing. Don't start handling players, but see if you can use your presence to deter. Warn players in a more open and public way. Discipline players in strict accordance with the laws if they're outside the laws. Don't accept it. You know, deal with it as necessary, but be strong. That's my message.
This is Referees World.
It's the Referees World podcast with Darren Cullum and Richard Mellin. Don't forget, you can contact us through the website, refereesworld.co.uk, and you can listen on iTunes. Just search iTunes for Referees World. Okay, we're moving on. We've had various emails that we're going to plough through as well. We've also got to mention the winners' names of our whistle competition from the last episode. But first, let's talk about, particularly as we head into the winter months, let's talk about pitch inspections.
Yeah, Dar, pitch inspections. We've all been involved in this discussion and the practical involvement of it. There's a lot of rain being around recently, and so consequently, waterlogging, soggy pitches are going to become evident.
Can we just say as well, at this point, for anybody who's listening in a really hot country, and we know that we've got listeners in over 50 countries that listen to this podcast, are probably thinking to themselves, rain? We don't get a lot of rain. We want to know about the hard ground. We'll get onto that in just a moment.
Exactly, yeah. So we're talking about the wet pitches at the moment here in the UK and anywhere else that may be in Europe that's suffering a lot of rain as we are. But when you're making a pitch inspection, how do you go about it? What's your particular practice, Darren?
Well, I'm quite lucky in that I think I've only ever had to call off two games. One was for a frozen pitch, and it was a no-brainer. But for a really wet pitch, I think it's a case of I had a situation recently where I was invited to go to the club at 1:30 in the afternoon. This is ready for a 7:45 kickoff. The rain had been falling for most of the morning. There were concerns about the pitch and how the pitch would chew up after this particular game if it went ahead. And the forecast obviously was quite heavy rain for the rest of the day. So the way I would deal with it is obviously go there with my boots, walk around the pitch, look at the areas which are likely to be chewed up, look at the lines, see how any potential assistant referee would benefit or not benefit from having a pitch in that condition. I think you get a general feel underfoot, don't you?
Yeah, the issue you've got to consider with wet pitches is how well the ball will run. And my advice to referees is, if you've got a reason to be called in to do a pitch inspection, or you've got doubts that you get out there on a Sunday morning game and you're there 45 minutes before kickoff, put a pair of welly boots in there with you, or put your own boots and a pair of socks on. Take a ball out there and go out there and be seen to show concern, because you could be questioned, and kick the ball around, throw the ball around, see how it bounces. And if you're trying to sell the decision that you're going to call it off, go and find the worst possible place. and hopefully it will be in a prominent place in the goal area, in the centre circle, down the middle of the field of play, or a lot of lying water out on the right side or the left side, and be seen to go in those areas rather than stand on the touchline or, you know, in somewhere inside nice and warm making a decision it's not good enough to play on. If the ball doesn't run, then that's problems for players because the ball is not where the players expect. So consequently, you have an obligation for player safety. And we come back to that cliche again, player safety.
What would you say to those people that say, well, hang on a sec, referee, the pitch is fine. It's just that little bit in the corner there that's a bit dodgy.
Okay, maybe that piece in the pitch, corner of the pitch, 45 minutes before the game, someone could do a little bit of work on it. Is that possible? You know, you haven't got to call it off 45 minutes before. If there's a little corner that is a bit dodgy, see if you can get a fork into it and help the situation. But, you know, look at the whole field of play. Look at the main areas and consider, is it safe for the players? And if you start the game, can you finish the game?
I was just about to say, actually, another thing that I would do is bear in mind, if I start this game, I'm going to want to finish it. Now, if I play on this pitch and halfway through it's going to get so chewed up that it's not going to be playable, then I wouldn't start the game from the first place.
Absolutely right. And there's no point in being a hero for an hour and then being a villain for the next 3 or 4 weeks because the pitch is not playable.
I was going to say, I think you need to look ahead for the next few games as well, you know, particularly if you share a football pitch.
Yeah. I mean, teams won't appreciate a referee taking a gamble on the pitch on a Saturday and then they lose the next three matches in succession because, you know, you took that risk. And you wrote the pitch off.
Okay, moving on. I've completely forgot what we were going to do next.
Hard pitches.
Oh, that was it, yeah. So I think that pretty much covers wet, soggy pitches. What about those harder pitches, like the ones in the hotter countries or frozen pitches? Now, here's an interesting one, Rich. Referees will call off a game in the winter because of a frozen pitch. Yet when you get to the summer months, the pitch is equally as hard, but nobody minds playing on it. Where do you stand with that?
I think I want to be careful here, but I'm also going to be sort of a bit of devil's advocate because having had the opportunity to go abroad and referee in hot climate, and I refer to India in this case, where I went last year, the playing facility is clearly marked, no doubt about that, but the quality of it is not that good. But players will not slide tackle on hard grounds or very, very rarely slide tackle. So, you know, I'll use the extreme. When I saw the game out in India, they did not even think about slide tackling because the conditions didn't allow them. And that's what conditions do. They will either encourage slide tackling or deter slide tackling. So if we go to this country in the UK, when the pitches are fairly hard in August and September, and they have got a good amount of grass on them, how many times does a player go down and get that awful scrape along the side of his leg, having made a sliding tackle and regrets it? And he's got a nasty scab on his leg for weeks and weeks. So, you know, there are situations to consider. But let's go into the pitch inspection side of it. Let's talk about the frozen ground here in the UK. And that could happen, say, next month, December, January, when it gets much colder. What do you consider there, Dar, when you're looking to do a pitch inspection with a slightly frozen ground or hard frost overnight? Will it defrost in time for kickoff?
You have to consider, will it defrost in time for kickoff? But you also have to consider the days are a lot shorter and that, you know, after midday, the day will actually start to get cooler. And remembering on most games, we don't kick off until about 2. So from the moment you kick off, the pitch will gradually become sort of cooler and cooler. So yeah. Come the end of the game, it could actually be quite hard. And sod's law working the way that it works, if there's going to be an incident that'll happen on the only tiny little part of the pitch that's frozen, that's where it'll happen.
Yeah, I mean, what you're looking for on the frozen pitches is hard tractor marks type of thing, you know, where the lawnmower's been out there or the gang mowers have been out there and it's left a little bit of a trench. And, you know, players go over on their ankle and that's a nasty, you know, accident.
Or those pitches that the referee allowed played in the dirty rain a few weeks before, where the pitch is all chewed up, that's all now frozen. So it's become really knobbly, but very hard knobbly.
Yeah, hasn't been rolled because they've not been able to get a roller on it. But players say, oh, we've played on worse than this, referee. Just think about the quality of the game. And on frozen pitches, the ball will bounce higher. So the ball is about knee height, waist height, and the ball is not where the players want it to be on the floor. So consequently, challenges are much more dangerous because the feet are raised and all sorts of things come into question as regards what you need to consider as a referee. Again, I would say frozen pitches, Sunday mornings, if the sun hasn't defrosted it by 11 o'clock, I wouldn't think it's going to defrost because, as you rightly highlighted, after midday, it starts getting colder again. So, you know, maybe the right decision is not the decision to take a risk and play a game on a frozen pitch with ruts and bumps and lumps where players can get serious injury, especially if they've got to go to work the next day. You don't want to be the referee that gets accused of taking a risk. And, you know, that's where we are here in the UK. Let's go back one, though, Dad. Let's talk about the hard pitches in August and September, because people will say they're just as hard in that period of the year as they are in January and December. But what's the difference?
Well, the difference is it's been a lot warmer and we've all enjoyed the summer and we want to play the game because we've had a break.
OK, yeah, you've touched on it exactly right. The difference between August and September and January, December is the fact is January, December, there's frozen water in the ground, whereas August, September, it's not frozen water. It's just rock hard soil. So that's the basic difference between them. One is more dangerous to run on, which it becomes slippery, and one is not so slippery. Although they're both just as hard, there is a significant difference between the two. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So pitch inspections, there will be challenges for referees about that. And I just want to say to my colleagues, please don't take the risk. If you've got any doubts, say, I'm sorry, lads, I'm thinking safety here. I don't think it's fit for play. If it's 50-50, stay on the side of safety.
Hopefully that'll give you some idea as to how you should approach your pitch inspections over the coming months.
This is Referees World.
It's the Referees World podcast. Don't forget, you can contact us through the website, refereesworld.co.uk. And we're getting contact from people all over the place that are just discovering the podcast. So that includes you. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you for following us on Twitter as well, at Referees World. Neil Irvine has emailed us. Neil's with the Essex County FA. He goes on to say, guys, only just found the podcast on iTunes the other day. Really enjoying listening to your work and gradually working through all the episodes. My question may have already been covered. However, can you clarify the current stance in wearing of jewellery? I've always insisted on zero jewellery being worn, which includes wedding rings, etc. However, I understand at a recent referee assessors meeting, the issue was raised and apparently a letter from Ian Blanchard at the FA has been doing the rounds, which suggests that wedding bands can be worn subject to the referee being satisfied that it is safe. What are your thoughts on this? Rich, over to you.
Neil, the letter that allegedly has come out from Ian Blanchard, have you seen a copy of it? I've not heard anything about this. Your zero tolerance to jewellery is absolutely right. That is the approach that all referees should take, zero tolerance to jewellery.
Including those little stringy bands that people are wearing these days. I know it might be supporting a charity. However, they could cause some disruption through the game.
Yeah, get hooked by the hand, pulled, you know, not intentionally, but just get hooked and, you know, all sorts of accidents can happen from it. And those are outlawed as well.
Neil, thanks very much for your email. Rich, you've got one from our old mate Fez, who's been listening to the podcast since day one.
Hello, Fez. Good to hear from you, mate.
Fez has sent us about 30 emails.
Fez, get away from refereeing a while. Let's get out there refereeing it and not talking about it. Anyhow, let's deal with the one about blowing the whistle.
Yeah.
Sounds a bit basic, but
Fez goes on to say, I've just finished reading Seeing Red by Graham Pohl. He raised some good points. However, not taking everything for granted, I question at least one of his thoughts. When does a referee blow for the end of the game?
Okay. It's about game management, isn't it? You know, who controls the timing of the game?
The referee.
Yeah. Who decides when to blow the whistle?
The referee.
Okay. So think about this. Does the referee stop the watch every time the ball goes out of play?
Not always, no.
Okay, so it's at his discretion when to stop the watch and when to end the first half or the second half, yeah?
Yep.
Okay, so it's not the decision of spectators, players or the assessor, yeah? Right, let's go into a couple of ideas here. 30 seconds to go on the match and think about your game management. Let me say example one. Scoreline is 3-0. It doesn't matter who's winning. The losing side have been beaten soundly. You've cautioned a couple of players. You might have even sent a couple of players off. So why do you prolong the experience of the extra hassle? And just, it doesn't matter if you blow the whistle 10 seconds early. Who knows? Who knows that you've blown the whistle 10 seconds early? How far does the ball travel in 3 seconds, Darren?
It can travel quite a way, depending on how hard it's been kicked, I suppose.
I mean, ideally, I would say stop play, finish the game, 40, 45 or 90. Ideally, when the ball is in a defensive area or in the midfield area or being taken as a goal kick and the ball is in flight.
Classic, I was just about to say.
Classic times, those.
Yeah, I always blow end of the game when the ball's in the air from a goal kick.
And why do you do that?
Because it's a kind of a neutral point in the game. If you blow the whistle in the middle of a challenge or do what I did on one particular game, which you saw, when the player was on an attack and had a clear run on goal, you're going to just cause yourself some problems.
Of course you do. Of course you do. So don't be controversial. Blow the whistle for the end of 45 or 90. When the ball is in a fairly neutral area, 2 or 3 seconds early, it will not hurt. If you let it go 2 or 3 seconds over, it doesn't matter. But what the message is do it at a sensible time. You don't have to be precisely on 45 minutes because you don't stop the ball. You don't stop your watch every time the ball is out of play. If you did, how long would the game go on for? You know, I think they did an assessment or analysis a few years back. How much playing time is there in a game of 90-minute football? And I think, if I remember correctly, it was something roundabout. It was timed as 62 minutes approximately that the ball was actually in play. So, you know, I think sometimes we look too deeply into certain areas of refereeing. Let me just say to you, this is a little tactic that I use, and it's not just me because I learned it off of others, is that blow the whistle when the ball is being taken as a goal kick once the ball is in the air because you haven't got to go and get the ball. Make sense?
Yep.
Yeah? If the ball's in the air from the goal kick, where's it likely to land?
In the midfield area.
And where will you be, referee?
Probably in the midfield area.
Hey, if the ball's gone out for a throw-in or a goal kick and you blow the final whistle, what are the players going to do?
They'll walk away from it.
Walk off and go and get changed. Who was given the ball at the start of the game?
Referee was.
Who's expected to give the ball back at the end of the game?
Referee is.
see all those little things that we learn? Yeah.
And that's what the whole idea of this podcast is about, to give you those little tips.
Sure. Let's talk about one more example as regards when to blow the whistle. Scoreline's 0-0 in a cup match. It looks like extra time. Can you get a result without being controversial? How long does it take for a ball to be moved from defence to an attack? 10 seconds?
Less than that.
Yeah. Let the attack finish. So, so what if you've slightly overplayed? Let the goal be stand. At least restart the match from the centre and then blow the whistle. It could be the best cup match you've ever played, and it ends 1-0, decisively without incident. See what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah? What about a tight league match? Scores 1-0, and the losing team is pressing for an equaliser. Show a little bit of empathy. Clever game management. Use the game time. Allow perhaps 10, 15 seconds for that attack to peter out. The one down at Watchet Town, Darren, yeah?
Yeah.
Referee is the sole discretion of time or extended time for stoppages, yeah? You know, that's what it's all about. Bit of game management.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your email, Fez. Great to hear from you again, and thanks very much for listening. And, of course, you can contact us, as we said, through the website, refereesworld.co.uk.
Darren, I've got one more question for the colleagues. I had an email from Sean Morgan-Smith, who's...
In Australia, I think, wasn't he?
Yes, he is, yeah. Okay. Penalty's been given. Everything with the penalty complies with law. The penalty taker is the opposition's goalkeeper. The goalkeeper, taking the penalty, strikes the ball, it hits the crossbar, and it goes directly back to the goalkeeper who's taking the penalty, who heads it only to a defender. The defender clears it upfield to his forward, who's standing in his own half onside. He collects the ball, goes through, and scores. The referee has played advantage. Correct or not?
Let's leave that as a pose and invite some emails.
Okay.
That's a great one, actually. And then we can discuss it at the beginning of the next podcast episode.
Do I need to explain it again, do you think?
Yeah, just recap once again.
Okay. Right. A penalty kick has been given. Last few minutes, it doesn't mean a difference here. But the opposing goalkeeper is taking the penalty kick. He strikes the ball. It hits the crossbar and goes directly back to him. As he heads the ball, he only succeeds in heading it towards the defending fullback. The defending fullback clears it upfield to his playing colleague, who is onside. He goes through, scores a goal, the referee applies advantage. Correct or incorrect?
That is a great one. I like it. So if you've got any thoughts on that, then drop us an email through the website, refereesworld.co.uk, and we'll discuss it in our next episode.
Yeah.
Can we just say congratulations, by the way, to the winners of the competition to blag a free whistle, courtesy of bestwhistle.com. In the last episode, we asked the question, who said...
People are on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is now.
And the answer was, of course...
Kenneth Wilson-Holm.
First 10 correct answers came from John Theopolis, Ian Brash, Rhys Astle, Nigel Hibbard, Steve Porter, Steve Austin, Ross McMenemy. Well done, guys. Your whistles should be in your boxes by now because we sent them out a while back. But thanks very much for getting involved and thanks for our friends at bestwhistle.com. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to this episode. We'll be back soon with the Referees World podcast.
The download is complete.